Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith, author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. His blog of twominds.com has logged over 55 million page views and is number 7 on CNBC's top alternative finance site. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Always a pleasure.
I thought today we'd talk about trade, the potential for developing trade wars, where this could ultimately lead, and just what's behind it. Like, how have we gotten to this point? We see a lot of not just with U.S., but internationally, trade issues, trade war issues. Just this week, Brazil accusing the EU of instigating trade war threatens a World Trade Organization complaint. So it's all over the globe now. You recently had a discussion with our co-founder, Gordon T. Long, and just wondering if you might relate that in terms of how financial oppression has caused the trade wars.
Right. It's a great topic, Richard, and I'm glad you brought up the issue with Brazil and the EU, showing that this is not just an issue with, say, the US and China, which gets a lot of publicity, but it's a global phenomenon. And so the roots are global as well. And at least one of the roots is financial repression, which is the central banks, the major central banks' policies over the last 9 years of recovery to drop interest rates to zero, to buy risk assets, to push investors into risk assets, and generate a lot of liquidity and credit. And so what's happened, one of the results of that is corporations have had an easy time borrowing a lot of money. And of course, some of that's been spent buying back their own shares and so on. But there's also been a great expansion of capacity, especially in emerging economies like China, where the government is explicitly trying to create jobs. There's been a huge amount of money poured into generating more capacity. In other words, there's more factories, more production, more mines opening. And so the world is awash in most things. There's too much of everything because of this overcapacity. And so what that has led to in the private sector is a loss of pricing power. In other words, when there's an oversupply and overcapacity, then you can't really charge enough to make a good profit. And so then the corporations with global exposure have to start cutting costs. And we've seen this leads to this sort of endless cycle where first they offshore production, then they offshore the back office, then they slash and burn their payroll, then they move from salaried employees to contract labor. And, you know, there's all this way of cutting, but eventually you get through the fat and the meat, and then pretty soon you're cutting the bone, right? And then you end up with zombie yeah. corporations, which are still producing, and they're only surviving because they keep borrowing. yeah. And, of course, in China, that's the whole model of the so-called SOEs, right? The state-owned enterprises, which they lose money and the state understands they lose money and they just borrow more money so they can keep their payrolls up. But outside of that kind of government subsidy, it creates a world in which nobody can really make enough money to justify their valuations. And so then the national governments start turning to trade wars as a way of getting back pricing power and limiting the overcapacity and oversupply that's crushing their domestic economies.
Do you think the trade wars could be implemented via tariffs or via global competitive currency devaluations?
That's a great question, Richard, and because part of what makes any discussion of trade so complicated is that, of course, currencies are the sort of the foundation of the of trade, because if a currency is greatly devalued, then those products are cheaper, right, for other buyers in other currencies. And so, or if a currency gains in relative value, then it's that nation's exports become expensive, and then their exports suffer. So everybody's, they talk about competitive devaluation, right? And that's the policy in which everybody tries to weaken their currency, but it's a zero-sum game. We can't all weaken our currency, right?
Yeah.
It's like if one currency loses value, it's against a basket of other currencies. And so there's some question as to whether that's really going to work. In other words, if you're the only country that can that's devaluing your currency, and everybody else is stable, then you can get away with that and gain an advantage. But then if everyone else is starting to play the game, then where will that lead? It's not really a solution.
Yeah. And if let's delve a little bit more in detail on the U.S. and the U.S. trade deficit. You've graciously provided a number of slides. If you can go through those and provide insight on each.
Yeah. Well, you know, Richard, another thing that I find fascinating with this trade is that it ties in the entire global economy. And so we talked about financial repression and central bank policies, how that influences it, then how currencies influence trade. And then in terms of tariffs, I think it's important to mention that many countries such as Japan protect their domestic industries without using tariffs. They just simply use bureaucratic mazes and moats. So, for example, if you're going to export something to Japan, you have to go through a bunch of different hoops with various ministries. And the ministries are, of course, well trained to find some reason to put your application aside for 6 months and then another 6 months. And we have some more research we need to do. And so anyways, there's more than one way to protect domestic industries, and bureaucratic mazes are actually more effective than tariffs. And I think we may get into the political side of this later in the program. But you know, Trump has announced a bunch of tariffs and then he quickly announces a bunch of exemptions.
Yeah.
So, a bureaucratic maze is actually way more effective way to control your, protect your domestic industries. But to go through my charts, the first chart is of U.S.-based corporate profits. And it's kind of interesting that those profits around 2000, which had shot up a lot as a result of the dot-com and boom of the late 90s, they were about $700 billion a year. And then China enters the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in 2001. And very quickly, U.S. corporate profits basically triple. Now, that tells you, I don't think that's coincidence. That's a stretch. So clearly, who's benefited from the expansion of trade in emerging productive markets like China? It's U.S. corporations. And people have tried to do research that, because the cost of goods at Walmart are cheap because, you know, the production's overseas, they've kind of guesstimated that the American consumer might have saved $200 billion or something like that in the last, you know, set number of years. But if you look at corporate profits going from $700 billion to $2.4 trillion, U.S. the corporations have pocketed trillions.
Yes.
The consumer has pocketed nickels. Then another chart I have here is U.S. oil production has gone up quite a bit, as everyone knows, because of fracking and other technologies. And so this has really relieved the pressure on the total U.S. Trade deficit, much of which was energy, right? In other words, importing, when the U.S. was importing 6 to 8 million barrels of oil a day, that's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of energy, right? And so now that U.S. production has increased, the U.S. is actually, it continues to import energy products, but it also is exporting some of its oil as well. And of course, we all know Canada, and Mexico, North America as a whole is an energy exporter, Canada and Mexico. So anyways, the U.S., bottom line has been impacted positively by its oil increase. Yeah. Yes. And I have a couple of charts here about breaking down the U.S. trade deficit. And it's interesting because, you know, we tend to think of it as a national thing, right? Like, what's the trade deficit with China, or what's the trade deficit with Germany, or whatever. This tells us that almost half the goods trade deficit is related to autos and vehicles.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting kind of fact. And then it's obviously a broad, in other words, imports and exports are really broad parts of the economy. In other words, they're not just, it's not just soybeans and steel or aluminum. It's a lot of different products from my next chart here, from around the world. You'll see that the U.S. runs trade deficits with most of the world. Mm-hmm. And then another chart I have here is, it's from somebody else. These are not my labels, but they show the trade deficit, which used to be extremely modest back in the early post-war years. And then once we got a bubble economy, you know, where the central bank was pouring in tremendous amounts of liquidity into the banking sector and into the economy, then we get a bubble economy, and then that's when our trade deficits skyrocketed. And of course, that's a bit simplistic because, of course, oil was a big part of our imports, and the strength of the dollar made it convenient to buy other people's products, right? Because when your currency, increases in relative value, yes, then it becomes even cheaper for you to buy other nations' outputs, right? So mm-hmm. There's a lot going into that huge increase in the national trade deficit there. And then the last chart is of the iPhone supply chain, which is interesting because, you know, the trade is not calculated with any kind of accuracy. You know, yes, that it's very difficult now because of the global supply chain to make sense of what trade really is. And this is a good example, because if an iPhone is shipped from China and lands at the dock in Long Beach, uh-huh, it's credited as a $500, say, you know, import from China. Yeah. But if we look at the components, they're made in Japan, South Korea, Europe, America, and other nations, that as much as $480 of that $500 quote import, wow, from China, yeah, is actually imported from elsewhere. Yeah. And so as little as $10 or $20 may actually stay in the Chinese economy. And that if we calculated the trade in that way, some people, they actually claim that the trade deficit with China basically disappears. Mm. It's so much of what China does is assemble components made elsewhere, that it's that huge trade deficit with China is illusory to some degree.
Yeah, it's sort of illusory, somewhat misleading, right, in terms of how we measure trade, and that's leading to misunderstanding as well.
Yes, that's right. Much like GDP, you know, includes a lot of stuff that doesn't really mean that the economy's becoming more productive.
Mm. Now, what about what's happening in terms of the U.S. Trump administration? Do you think their strategy is to use these trade tariffs, potential trade wars, as a bargaining chip for trade treaty negotiations in order to get the U.S. a better deal?
Yeah, I think we see some evidence to support that, Richard. And of course, that was one of Trump's campaign kind of promises, was to cut a better deal. And it's interesting that I'm thinking of when he first announced this sort of trade war kind of policy, then companies like BMW suddenly announced they were expanding their assembly of vehicles in the U.S.
Wow.
So, in other words, it's an interesting dynamic, because if you get a political threat, then corporations don't really have the luxury of waiting around to see how that policy is implemented. They see the writing on the wall. They see the political narrative shift, right? They see the trajectory. And so then it makes sense for them to go ahead and increase their production of an assembly in the U.S. And just, in other words, be proactive. Don't wait around for the trade war to heat up. Just go ahead and increase, move your product line and some assembly to the U.S. ahead of it, ahead of the curve, so to speak. And so we're starting to see some of that.
Yeah. And speaking of the political angle, there was recently the discussion of placing 25% tariff on soybeans, U.S. soybeans. Could this be a political ploy by China in order to aggravate the backing of Trump supporters in the U.S. Midwest, where a lot of soybeans are grown?
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating supposition, Richard. I'm glad you brought that up because, of course, any kind of announcement regarding trade will have a domestic impact on the companies that are producing, you know, those goods, right? And so, yeah, it's undoubtedly that the Chinese leadership are trying to undermine Trump's political support with that. And of course, if you've ever driven through Iowa, for example, much of the state is soybean fields and wheat fields and corn fields. I mean, you know, so the U.S. is certainly a breadbasket, a grain and soybean producer of global proportions. And so there was some analysis that came out that said, well, that sounds nice. You know, the Chinese trying to say they're going to raise the price of U.S. soybeans, but the world does not have an oversupply of soybeans. And so they can buy some from Brazil, who's another major producer, but their demand is so large that they're going to end up having to buy U.S. soybeans anyway.
Yeah, I think so, there's like 400 million pigs in China that need to be fed. So without that soybeans, they're going to run into a lot of problems. There's only about 14 million tons domestic production in China, is my understanding.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and you know, this is where it's very fascinating to drill down because, you know, like people are now saying, well, what about rare earth metals, right? Because China's got almost a monopoly on some of those rare earths. And you can get into some electronic components and chemicals that that the Japanese have almost a lock on, that there's, you know, for relatively modest parts of key industries. It turns out there's only a couple of factories in the world that make these things. Mm. And so that's why we have to be careful about a sledgehammer, you know, to drive a attack, right?
Yeah.
But politically, it's also interesting to ask, is it really true that the U.S. has just been a dumping ground for the last 30 years? In other words, everybody else can overproduce and they can dump their overproduction into the U.S. market.
Yeah.
And maybe it has been unfair. And yeah. And of course that's, nobody wants to talk about that, but I do wonder if that's actually a valid perception, because as I mentioned with like the BMW thing and a lot of the Chinese, kind of machinations, people don't want to lose the U.S. market. It's too big. It's too important. There is no substitute. So In a way, Trump has a little more leverage really than the exporters, as far as I can see.
And so do you think the U.S. and China will follow through on these plans for tariffs, or do you think that they'll be pushed back by the market in other countries and just economic forces in general?
Yeah, you know, it's a great topic, Richard. And you, before we started recording, you sent me an interesting article from the economist Barry Eichengreen, who I understand you're going to interview in the near future.
Yes.
And he was talking about the fact that China and countries like China with higher export to GDP ratios than the U.S. In other words, these are export-dependent mercantilist economies. They really don't want to encourage a trade war because they're going to be a much bigger loser than importing countries.
Yes. They're sort of more for free trade than the U.S., ironically.
Right, right, exactly. And it, to me, you know, it's interesting how to look at the model that's been, that's often held up as being remarkably successful since the end of World War II, right, 70 years ago, which is the mercantilist model that Japan followed, which was protect domestic industries at all costs, and then use government money and power to boost your export sector, right? And do everything you can to make it easy for corporations to expand their production for selling overseas, you know, the export sector. And then that enriches your nation, right? And then that was the South Korea followed that model, the Asian Tigers, and China's pursued that model with great success. But then now we look back at China, at what's happened to Japan after that whole export sort of burst ended in a financial bubble, and they've been stagnant. And part of why they've been stagnant for 20 some years is that when you protect your domestic industry, you protect a bunch of inefficient, unproductive industries.
Yeah.
And then those companies don't really make enough money to become more efficient. So they become sort of like a zombie sector. You know, there's some employment, but they struggle. And because there's no competition really with, you know, from overseas. And so there's, to say that that model is successful, it's only successful in the boost phase. But once you get to the point where you've protected a bunch of inefficient and unproductive domestic sectors, and you run into competition on the global stage with your export sector, then you get stagnation. And, you know, Japan's export sector is still large, but look at the profitability problems they're having. You know, it turns out like their big electronics companies, you know, Toshiba, Panasonic, they're riddled with financial scandals because they've been overstating their profits by, you know, trillions of yen for years, right? They're really not profitable anymore.
Yeah.
So much for the mercantilist model. It only works for a while. It's not a permanently successful model. There is blowback, mm-hmm. unintended consequences. So, you know, put another way, trees don't grow to the sky.
Yeah, exactly. And now, rather than imposing like these tariffs, could the U.S. administration focused action on intellectual property rights, you know, in terms of the dispute between the U.S. and China on IP and intellectual property? Could that happen?
Right. It's important, you know, because a lot of what the U.S. exports is software and films, entertainment. And so all of those things are easily pirated. And we all know stories that, you know, you can get the you can get the DVD of the movie in Hong Kong streets before it's even released,
okay.
know, in the theaters, right? And you know, we have a lot of friends in China, and you know, they report to us that they said, well, in general, the Chinese people, the sort of general view is that software is like air. You know, it should be free to everybody. And so it's not considered quote theft as we would see it, or as Microsoft and other companies would see it. And so trying to control the theft of intellectual property is very difficult. It's worth doing. I mean, I think you have to make an effort if your export sector is heavily dependent on intellectual property like the US is. But I just don't know how much you can, how much you can really change that dynamic. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. They're very difficult to stop thievery, except at the official level.
Mm. And where do you see all of this going in terms of the next phase of trade wars, trade discussions? Could this cause inflation, you know, in consumer prices? Because, you know, now the U.S. has to actually make the dishwasher or, you know, microwave oven here rather than import because of the large tariffs. You know, do you see that as potentially happening, much higher inflation?
Right. I do wonder about that. You know, that people were starting to say, oh, well, you know, you put on tariffs on steel and aluminum and that's going to ripple through the economy. But you know, the I guess then we have to start asking, well, what percentage of our products are basic materials like aluminum and steel and soybeans, you know. And of course, if you take like a box of cold cereal, breakfast cereal, it turns out that the grain is something like, you know, a nickel or a dime of the $3.
Right. Yeah.
So
okay.
So I think it might be, if we look for inflation, it could be in finished goods. If there's tariffs on finished goods, that could really hurt. Right, like auto parts. I mean, you know, that's our components. So when they, if people start slapping 25% tariffs on finished goods, that could have a very big impact. But then, like I said, the alternative view is if those producers decide to move their production to the U.S. and go ahead and absorb the higher labor costs and taxes here.
Yeah.
It might be a wash. In other words, the actual sticker price might not go up that much, or there would be benefits in terms of supporting U.S. employment that a certain amount of higher prices would be offset by, bringing the supply chain home, stronger employment here, more taxes being paid, and so on.
And finally, what are your thoughts on how this could potentially lead, trade wars potentially lead to physical wars? Like if we absorb this more, more labor in the U.S., that would take away labor in China, and the ruling party there is very concerned about that causing social unrest. So could all of this morph into physical wars?
Right. And there's a famous quote by the French economist Bastiat from the 19th century. And I'm just paraphrasing. I don't have it in front of me, but it was he said or wrote something along the lines of, if goods don't go across borders, then soldiers will go across borders.
Wow. Yeah.
Kind of implying that dynamic that you're mentioning. I think it's, trade is about between 10 and 20% of most major economies, right? Imports and exports together. So, we have to try to remember that the scale, we're not talking about most countries having 50 to 60% of their economy based on imports and exports, right? So the trade is a critical sector of every economy, but I think the potential for disruption politically is in those countries that are super dependent on trade, and that would include Germany, of which about 40% of their GDP is related to trade, as I recall, and China, and these mercantilist-based economies. They are much more likely to suffer political blowback and domestic turmoil in a escalating sort of trade war environment. And I think that domestic political turmoil and disorder is much more likely than a shooting war because, trade wars are relatively controllable compared to an actual combat war where there's really high risks that the thing gets out of control. And so I think that it's more likely that there'll be domestic turmoil. And that will, that's what politicians will focus on, is how to deal with their domestic turmoil as a result of trade being disrupted.
Wow, that's great insight, Charles, on this potential for trade wars. And we can end it there. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. I got free chapters of my most recent books and big archives, and come visit me at oftwominds.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Charles.
Okay, thank you, Richard. My pleasure.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.